Imagine you sit down to play like a board game with your friends or your family. You're dealing the cards, setting up the pieces, getting ready for a fun night.
Right, everybody's having a good time.
Exactly. But when you open the rule book, you notice this specific clause printed right at the very bottom, and it is written specifically for you.
Oh no, that's never good.
No, it's not. It says that no matter what moves you make or, how hard you try to cooperate, your pieces are cursed. Your only permitted function in this game is to be the bad guy.
Wow.
Yeah, you are the designated villain. The rules physically prohibit you from ever winning or even doing anything good.
I mean, that sounds incredibly isolating. You're just trapped in a system where your sole purpose is to be defeated. Like,
Right.
you only exist to provide friction and cohesion for everyone else playing. It just strips away your free will entirely.
It is a complete psychological nightmare. And well, that nightmare is the exact premise of today's deep dive. So,
Yeah.
welcome in to our curious listener out there.
Glad to have you with us.
Today, we are exploring this genuinely mind-bending puzzle box of a narrative. Okay, let's unpack this. We've got this multi-layered story that constantly weaves back and forth between two distinct realities.
Right, there's the magical high fantasy portal world called Mirari.
And then there's a very normal, totally mundane mortal town called Ainenton. And our mission today is to track a sprawling treasure hunt for a foundational document known as the Book of History.
Which is such a cool concept.
It really is. But beneath the magic and the mystery, we're really hunting down a profound question. What happens when the literal structural rules of your world force you to be a monster?
What's fascinating here is that we are looking at a masterclass in how history, institutional laws, and deeply personal trauma all intertwine to, well, literally create reality.
Yeah.
We're going to see how the architecture of an entire universe was built on the foundation of a childhood grudge.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. And as we track this journey, we get to watch the characters slowly realize that the only way to save their world isn't to fight the bad guys on the battlefield. The only way to survive is to dismantle the architecture of reality itself.
And for you listening, keep this in the back of your mind as we go through this material today. Because whether you're navigating a rigid corporate hierarchy or just, trying to survive your own family's Thanksgiving
Oh,
dynamics,
we've all been there.
right, understanding exactly who wrote the rules you're living by, that is the ultimate cheat code. So let's jump right into the dust and the dark. We start off deep underground in the Royal Mausoleum of Merari.
Yeah, and the setting here immediately grounds us in the way of the past. We have Thomas, who is a lord explorer of this magical realm, and he's brought along his mortal friend, Simon.
Which is a dangerous place for a mortal to be.
Very. And standing between them and the inner sanctum, where this ancient book of history is supposedly kept, is this massive dark walnut door guarded by a giant stone lion.
A talking stone lion, which is just inherently intimidating. But I want to pause on the mechanics of this encounter because it sets the tone for everything.
Right, it's not just a monster to fight.
Exactly. The lion acts as the ultimate gatekeeper. It demands to know by what right Thomas seeks entrance to the foundational truths of their world. Thomas actually has to claim his heritage.
He traces his lineage back to the founding houses of Merari. Specifically, he notes that his ancestors came from two bitterly feuding houses, November and the House of February, led by Lady Charisse.
Right, and they were disowned for falling in love, right?
Exactly. Notice how the text is already highlighting the theme of breaking rigid rules. Thomas's very existence is a testament to defying traditional boundaries.
But the lion is a creature of old magic, so just a verbal claim isn't enough. It requires a physical sacrifice. Thomas has to surrender this incredibly powerful magical artifact he carries.
The Flute of Bram.
Yeah, the Flute of Bram. Just to prove he has no ill intent, he has to render himself completely vulnerable to seek the truth.
Which leads them into this grand hall of statues honoring past kings. And we get a massive lore drop here about a figure named King Riordan.
Now, I need to make sure I understand the mechanics of this. Thomas explains that before Merari was a structure world with like gravity and laws and kingdoms, it was just chaotic rolling spirits. Nothing was permanent.
Right, pure chaos.
And King Riordan willingly gave up his existence. He essentially died or passed into history just to give the magical beings a stable reality. He sacrificed himself to create continuity out of chaos. How does that actually work?
Think of it as the ultimate myth of state building, but literalized through magic. Chaos is infinite potential, But you can't build a house on infinite potential. You need solid ground.
Makes sense.
So Riordan's life force acted as the binding agent that turned shifting magic into permanent physical laws. He codified the universe. But the tragic irony, and really the core theme of the sources we are looking at today, is that the very order Riordan died to create eventually becomes a barrier. The rules that say the society in its infancy often become the cage that traps it in its maturity.
And the story gives us a perfect literal symbol of that cage right in the next room. They get to the end of the mausoleum hall, and there is this rusted iron portcullis blocking the final chamber.
Right.
Thomas, this great, powerful Lord Explorer, walks up to the lever to open the gate, and he is suddenly paralyzed. He cannot touch the iron mechanism.
Because in traditional fairy lore, iron acts as an absolute counter to magic. It physically burns magical beings.
Right. But Thomas wasn't born magical, was he?
No, but he explains that even though he wasn't originally born in Mirari, he spent so much time there that the magical world has pulled him in deeply. He's become integrated into the system.
And because he is part of the system, the iron physically weakens him.
Yeah.
He is trapped by his own assimilation. I was reading this scene and I immediately thought of Legacy Code and a massive tech company.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. You have these brilliant software engineers who have been embedded in company's culture for a decade. They know all the lore, every line of the original architecture, all the internal politics.
Yeah.
But when the market shifts and it's time to actually change the rusted machinery of the company to adapt, they cannot do it. They are physically burned by the red tape, paralyzed by the very system they helped build.
Exactly. So who actually opens the gate? It falls entirely on Simon.
The mortal kid.
Yeah. Simon is the complete outsider. He's a mortal kid with a fresh perspective, who hasn't been assimilated by the magical rules.
He literally has to get behind the lever and do a leg press, straining with all his mortal physical might just to force the rusted iron gates open. I love that image.
It's so visceral.
It takes an unburdened outsider, someone who doesn't respect the historical weight of the iron, to force the gates of the institution open.
It is a phenomenal metaphor for institutional change. And what do they find when they break through? They enter a chamber covered in incredibly realistic, magical murals depicting the founders of Mirari.
Right, but it's a trap, isn't it?
Completely. The entire room is a visual illusion designed to confuse anyone looking for logical doors.
Thomas has to basically close his eyes, ignore everything his highly trained senses are telling him, trust his instincts, and walk blindly through a shadow on the wall to break the illusion.
And then they finally reach the pedestal where the foundational rulebook is supposed to be. They look down, and it is a fake.
A total fake. They find a single journal page left by an ancient rival named Lord Melchizedek, mocking a figure named Lord Eoin.
The message essentially taunts him, asking if he truly thought it would be so easy to find the Book of History a second time.
It is a massive gut punch for the characters, but it shifts the entire investigation because finding this fake book that specifically taunts Lord Eoin, who is known in the magical lore of Mirari as the absolute ultimate evil, the destroyer.
The big bad.
Yeah, the big bad. It forces the story to pivot. The answer isn't in the magical realm. To understand the Destroyer, we have to look at the mortal world. We have to look at the town of Innichton.
Right.
And this is where we see the heartbreaking reality of what happens when a person is eternally cast in that villainous role.
Because to understand this, we really have to look at how these two worlds connect. The history of Mirari isn't just a random fantasy setting. Mirari was actually birthed into existence from the childhood games of real mortal children.
The Harcourt siblings.
Exactly. Their imaginations were so potent and perhaps mixed with ambient magic that their make-believe kingdom became a literal alternate dimension. And the Destroyer, Lord Eoin, is the magical avatar of a real-world boy named John Harcourt.
Hang on, if John Harcourt is the original mortal kid, who is John Cortland? Because when we cut to the mortal town of Innichton, we meet this guy, John Cortland, who's just walking down the street, but everyone is treating him like a dark lord.
Right, so Cortland is essentially the mortal echo. He's a descendant figure who bears a striking, handsome resemblance to the historical John Harcourt.
Okay.
And because of that physical resemblance to the boy who became the Destroyer, the town of Innichton, which has its own subtle awareness of the magic, projects all of that historical dread onto him.
And the scene we walk into perfectly illustrates this prejudice. In the middle of this totally normal town square, a magical talking horse named Ahern accidentally causes an elderly woman, Mrs. Smith, to faint from shock.
Right, just totally accidental.
Completely. But the townspeople immediately default to their ingrained narratives. They blame the horse, they blame the teenage girls who are standing nearby, and they turn their eyes on John Cortland with total suspicion.
And Cortland is just drowning in this inherited guilt. He looks at the teenage girls, Alice and Agatha, and he asks this incredibly plaintive, desperate question. He says, "Do I have to be the villain?"
It's sad.
It is. He is carrying the crushing weight of a narrative he didn't even write simply because he fits the visual profile of the established bad guy.
I love what happens next, though. Alice, this young girl who just radiates radical empathy, steps up. She looks at this man who represents the ultimate evil of the magical world, and she gives him a delicate little locket pendant.
Yeah.
And she tells him very simply that he doesn't have to be the bad guy if he doesn't want to be.
It is a profound moment of grace. Alice is rejecting the fundamental rules of the universe. She's telling him that self-determination and forgiveness are possible, even if the original creators of the game never offered it to him.
And we find out exactly why those creators never offered forgiveness when Agatha and John Cortland go to explore the abandoned Harcourt Manor.
Right, they go up into John Harcourt's childhood bedroom, which is perfectly preserved under decades of dust. And Agatha is poking around his old roll-top desk, and she finds a drawer with a false bottom.
Ooh, a secret compartment.
Exactly. And hidden inside are two items that completely recontextualize the entire history of the magical realm. First, they find the shattered pieces of a porcelain Pegasus named Ariel. And second, they find John Harcourt's personal childhood journal.
And the journal is intense, the handwriting is meticulous, but the words are just blistering with teenage rage. He writes about how much he hated his younger siblings, Anastasia and Bryant.
Because they excluded him.
Yeah, they constantly favored their fantasy game over him. He was furious that they wouldn't make him a king in their make-believe world. And in a moment of pure, destructive anger, he lashed out and broke his sister's prized porcelain Pegasus.
And that single act of sibling cruelty was the inciting incident for a universe. Because his siblings never forgave him, they codified his anger.
They wrote it into the rules.
Right. When their game manifested into the reality of Mirari, they wrote John into the foundation of that world as the ultimate eternal villain. He became the destroyer. His punishment was to be universally hated forever.
Wow.
But the physical evidence Agatha finds tells a slightly different story. When she looks closely at the broken pieces of the porcelain Pegasus, she sees traces of old powdery glue along the cracks.
Yes. John Harcourt secretly tried to fix what he broke. He wrote in his journal about digging the pieces up in the middle of the night after his siblings buried them in the yard.
Yeah.
He felt like Dr. Frankenstein, sitting in the dark, desperately trying to put this Pegasus back together. But okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to push back on this idea of the secret apology absolving him. Sure, it is deeply tragic that he tried to glue it back together in his room. But if you do it in the dark and you never actually show the people you hurt that you are sorry, I mean, does it count?
That's a very fair point.
How many people in the real world walk around acting like monsters, hurting their coworkers or their families just because they think it's too late to apologize? If you hide your remorse, aren't you still responsible for the monster you act like?
That is a crucial critique. Intent without action does not heal the wound you inflicted on someone else. A secret apology is mostly just for your own conscience. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the glue reveals the tragedy of absolute rigid systems.
Right.
John Harcourt wasn't a pure, irredeemable demon. He was a complex, hurting, prideful teenager who made a terrible mistake.
Right.
But his sibling's game calcified his momentary teenage anger into an eternal, immutable truth. They stripped him of his agency to grow. They trapped him in their narrative. He was the designated villain forever, with no mechanism for parole built into the rules.
And he eventually took his own life years later in the real world. It is devastating. And this revelation fundamentally changes the stakes of the entire story for our heroes.
It really does.
Simon and Alice realize that the destroyer in Mirari is only evil because the invisible rules of the game absolutely force him to be. The universe dictates his villainy.
Precisely. If the rules force the behavior, then defeating the villain in combat accomplishes nothing, right? The system will just generate another villain.
Yeah, you have to change the game.
Exactly. To save Mirari, they realize they need to find the real original rulebook and rewrite the operating system of the universe.
Which leads us to the wildest, most absurdly brilliant climax. We get this incredible cross-cutting between two totally different realities. Back in Mirari, all hell is breaking loose.
Oh yeah, massive siege.
There's a gory battle happening at the West Gate. Defenders on the walls are firing crossbows into an endless sea of undead skeletons and trolls. The apocalypse is actively happening.
But stakes could not be higher. Thomas, the Lord Explorer, realizes the answer isn't on the battlefield. He actually gets a magical golden lion tattoo from a sorceress named Nimue.
Right, as a tracker.
Yeah, it acts as a trans-dimensional tracking beacon for his friends. So he rushes to the royal gardens and steps into the royal siege, which is this magical portal made of moonlight and snow, and he crosses the boundary back into mortal dimension.
And the jarring transition when he arrives in Ainaton is just spectacular. Thomas, who is wearing literal chainmail, covered in the dirt of battle, carrying a broadsword, drops into the mortal town.
Right.
And he immediately has to dive headfirst into the bushes at a local public park. Why? Because sitting on a park bench, leisurely eating a carrot cake sandwich, is Mrs. Christie, the most incredibly boring English teacher in town.
The author uses a masterful juxtaposition here. You have the clashing swords and the armies of the undead on one side of reality, and on the other, an English teacher enjoying her lunch.
It's so funny.
But Simon and Thomas realize that the true book of history, the foundational rules of the magical dimension, is hidden inside the bronze base of an angel statue located exactly 2 feet away from Mrs. Christie's bench.
I have to ask, though, why an English teacher? Why a park bench? It feels so intentionally mundane compared to a mausoleum guarded by a stone lion.
It speaks to how you dismantle corrupt systems. You don't beat a rigged game by fighting it on its own epic, dramatic terms. You bypass the drama entirely. The banality of the park bench highlights that the rules governing us are often hidden in the most mundane, overlooked corners of our lives.
So Thomas and Simon are trapped in the bushes, and they desperately need a distraction. Enter Alice. Alice deploys the greatest weapon in the history of espionage. A breathless, endless, hyper-enthusiastic lecture from a little girl.
It's brilliant.
She skips over to Mrs. Christie and just unleashes a torrent of information. She talks about fairy politics, the lifespan rules of magical creatures, and whether Clydesdale horses make good kings.
And Mrs. Christie, being a dedicated teacher, completely engages with the madness. She doesn't dismiss Alice. She actually pulls out a bottle of nail polish to give Alice a manicure right there on the bench while they transition into a deep discussion about Shakespeare.
It provides the perfect auditory and visual cover. Meanwhile, Thomas and Simon are army crawling out of the bushes like commandos. They realize the bronze plaque on the statue has these tiny catches, and they need something very thin to pop them open.
Right.
Thomas whispers to Simon, and Simon casually leans out of the bushes and asks Mrs. Christie if they can borrow her nail file.
The tension in this scene is incredible, precisely because the stakes are so wonderfully low to the ground. Every click of the metal nail file, every rustle of the bushes could give them away to a teacher eating carrot cake.
But it works. Under the cover of Alice's relentless chattering about manicures, Thomas uses the borrowed nail file and two pieces of paper to perfectly jimmy the catches. The bronze plaque pops off.
And inside this dusty little compartment behind the statue, they find it. A heavy black leather tome. Thomas opens it and reads the very first page. It's the first rule of Merari, authored by the original founders, Lord Eolin, Lady Angelique, and Lord Bram.
The text explicitly states that these are the true and proper rules, and they cannot be amended. They literally stole the source code of reality using a cosmetic tool. So what does this all mean?
Wait.
The universe is saved not by a legendary hero striking down a dark lord with a magic sword, but by a little girl getting her nails painted while distracting a teacher.
This raises an important question, and it is a realization that Simon articulates beautifully earlier in the narrative. Simon points out that no matter what laws anyone makes, there is always a dark side.
Yeah.
If the invisible rules of your society, your workplace, or your family force people to do hideous things just to maintain the status quo, then the people acting out those roles aren't the true enemy. The rules themselves are the enemy.
Wow. Okay, let's bring this all together. What an unbelievable journey through these sentences. We started deep underground, being interrogated by a stone lion in a dusty mausoleum about the nature of sacrifice and legacy.
Right.
Then we crossed over into the mortal world, uncovering the tragic, glue-covered secrets of a teenager who was designated to be a villain for the rest of eternity just because he broke a toy.
And then the heist.
And we ended up hiding in the bushes, pulling off a daylight heist with a nail file behind an English teacher's back to steal the foundational rules of reality.
It is a brilliant, layered illustration of how the narratives we construct actively shape the reality we experience. John Harcourt was forced to act out a monstrous role because his siblings wrote a rule book that allowed for no grace no evolution, and no forgiveness.
Yeah.
The system demanded a villain, so it manufactured one.
And that connects directly back to you listening to this deep dive right now, because every single one of us operates under foundational rules that we didn't write. You step into a new job, and there are unspoken rules in the corporate culture about who gets heard in meetings and who gets ignored.
Exactly.
You go home for the holidays, and there are rules established 20 years ago by your parents about your assigned role. You know, you are the golden child, or you are the rebel, or you are the peacemaker.
Or you are the villain. And those roles are comfortable for the broader system, even if they are agonizing for the individual forced to play them. The system naturally resists change.
It puts up rusted iron gates that burn those who are too deeply embedded to push them open. It takes outside perspective, or willingness to step outside the prescribed rules, to effect real change.
Exactly. Which leaves us with a final provocative thought to mull over today as we wrap up. We've talked about family dynamics and corporate rules, but think about the digital spaces we inhabit every day.
Oh, that's a great point.
Think about the algorithms that govern our social media feeds. Those are literal foundational rules written by a handful of tech developers years ago in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, the invisible rule book.
Right. And those unseen rules dictate whether we act with empathy or whether we are pushed toward constant outrage just to generate engagement. Are we just playing out assigned roles in a digital version of Murari? Are the algorithms forcing us to be the villains in someone else's feed just to keep the system running?
It is a sobering thought. If we are operating in a system designed to weaponize our worst impulses, then fighting each other is exactly what the rulebook wants. The only way to win is to question the architecture of the platform itself.
Because maybe it's time for you to pry the bronze plaque off your own system's rules and rewrite them. You don't have to play the game if the rules force you to be the bad guy.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives around you. Keep looking for the hidden rulebooks, and we will catch you next time.